Accession number 27309, Reel 5.
Peter Duke, Reel 5. I believe after Operation Iceberg, you joined the US 3rd Fleet for Operation
Well,
Japan.
Yes, that's right. The fleet joined the fleet. Came under the command of the... Because the American 5th Fleet had been operating for some while, and they took over, the 3rd Fleet took over, Admiral Halsey, and the high-up instructions or orders or whatever you call them came from him to our Admiral and down to the working parties, as it were. So it didn't make any difference as far as we knew, you know. But that's actually what we were doing. Yeah.
What was Operation Japan?
Well, they'd captured Okinawa, and they were flying fortresses and things from Okinawa, bombing Japan, with obviously the basic idea of invading. And we were sent over mainly to... there were some remnants of the Japanese fleet still around. There were one or two aircraft carriers still about, and destroyers and one thing and another. And that was our primary target at first, to neutralize any shipping, even merchant shipping, of course, because they had to import all their oil and everything. So they were quite important targets. And anything else ashore that was worth attacking, installations of any sort. And yeah, that lasted a couple of months, and then they dropped the bomb, which saved us any further work.
So have you got any memories, obviously, of things that you attacked during that, the specific targets you attacked during Operation Japan?
Well, yes, one particular day, in fact, we got a signal about it from the Admiral. There it is. Yes, now hang on, where do we... Yes, on the 17th of July, which is just about 3 weeks before they dropped the bomb, we flew to Niigata on the west coast of Honshu Island. Now, Niigata was a big airfield. Looking at Japan, it's sort of up there. And that was a particular area that they wanted in neutralizing. I can't remember why. I don't think we were probably told why. But there was something there that they didn't like the look of or didn't want operating anymore, and they'd go and sort them out. And we did. It took us 2.5 hours to get there. And we attacked everything on the ground. One or two aircraft took off and flew about, which we dealt with. But most of it was a ground attack. There were quite a lot of aircraft on the ground, and we knocked most of them about. We got a signal from AC-1, who is the Admiral. Very glad to hear your Corsair has got to Niigata in such unfavourable cloud condition and left their mark. Oh, sweet. But it was a long way. Most of it was over land, of course. And hence this business of don't fly straight and level for more than a few seconds, because they'll catch you.
Was there much of a threat, really, from Japanese fighters at that time?
No, there wasn't. Occasionally you saw one, you know, either engaged him or he'd gone the other way or whatever. But no, there was not a lot of aircraft at all. And what there were, we soon saw them off.
And for that operation, was it an operation really to suppress the Japanese Air Force, would you have said? It's to keep them on the ground?
Yes, absolutely. And there was something about Niigata that the Americans didn't like, you know. It was always, I think, in the back of their minds was invasion. I shudder to think what would have happened if they had invaded. Honestly, it would have been terrible. Because the terrain of most of Japan is very inhospitable, except around the coast, you know. And you've only got to get a landing force turns up like on Normandy beaches and on these great big mountains and things all around, and you've only got to get a couple of Japanese up there with a machine gun or two, and then you would get nowhere landing, and the loss of life would have been incredible. But luckily, I think they did the right thing in the end, you know.
With the operation, was it the same as your normal kind of routine in the fact that you just made one pass over the airfield?
Oh, yes, yes. You could, I say one pass, what I meant was that you didn't do a run over the airfield and then turn around and come back again. You know, you could toddle off a few miles away and then turn around and then come back from another direction. And but if you turned around, they could still see you. And then came back for another run, it was suicidal.
So would you, on that operation, did you make more than one pass over the actual airfields?
I think we did, yes. Because we did quite a lot of damage, actually, on the airfield. Although there were only Corsairs, we weren't even Avenger bombing or anything. We had a bomb each, or two bombs. And then, of course, we had six machine guns, so it was quite efficient from that point of view.
Is it easy to hit targets on the ground?
Yes, not too difficult. Not always easy to hit them with a bomb, but you can certainly hit them with a machine gun.
Because around this period, I think you were awarded the DSC, weren't you? Was there any specific operation that was awarded for, or was it for...?
You never know, do you? Not in the case, like some people, of a particular operation. This was for general work, particularly over Japan, not Okinawa. But I think it all tied in. And I was one of the few pilots who flew from the very beginning of Iceberg, i.e. Sydney, Australia, right the way through all of this campaign until we got back to Sydney. And there weren't many pilots who were still aboard. Most of them who were aboard in the first place, and I joined them, were relieved after Okinawa, Iceberg. And fresh crew came on, in which case they joined at the end of Iceberg. But I had started Iceberg and then started and finally finished up, as I say, having done the whole lot. But not many people did. I don't know.
So are there any other incidents within Operation Japan that come to mind?
We went out one day to try and disrupt some land convoys which had been spotted, and on a particular highway, and there was a... it's no good just strafing a lot of lorries. It doesn't do a great deal of good in the end. Initially it does for an hour or two, but on this particular road or highway, there was a particular bridge that they didn't like the look of. They wanted it destroyed, because if you destroyed that bridge, there was no way round for the convoys to go except miles away, you know. And anyway, we attacked this bridge with quite considerable success. And that may have had something to do with the DSC, I don't know. But I hit it one bang in the middle. And the whole thing collapsed.
Did you actually see it collapse?
Oh, yes. Yes. And you sort of say, good hope. the other thing, I think, was when I got back to the ship on one occasion... the aircraft was full of shrapnel holes. It didn't affect the flying of it, but I thought, well, what's up? Where have all these holes come from?
But you'd have no memory of it.
It was peppered with shrapnel. Obviously, an anti-aircraft shell had burst, and the fragments had hit me. Luckily, I did feel, as a matter of fact, at the time, the plane sort of went like this. As if we had sort of gone over a bump in the road.
Sort of lifted.
Yes, lifted the tail of the plane up momentarily. And I thought, well, that's funny, it must have been an air pocket or whatever. But it wasn't, it was a agate fire that had burst just below me. Yeah. What have you done to my aeroplane? You know?
So how did you feel about the dropping of the atomic bombs?
In one way, very glad, because the longer this went on, as I say, I joined at the beginning of this campaign and gone right through, and the longer I flew on all these missions, the more I felt, well, when's my luck going to run out? Because I'd never been shot down, I'd never got my feet wet, never had the bailout. And, every time I took off, I thought, well, you get that feeling, I think, after a while, I suppose. And when they said cease operations, cease hostilities, I think we all felt a sigh of relief. But then after a few days you thought, well, that's a pity, in a way. And then we got a signal through, I probably quoted this before, but we were told, a lot of the Japanese didn't know the armistice hadn't been signed, the ceasefire had been broadcast, stop operations. But a lot of the Japanese didn't know this, particularly off these small atolls and things. They didn't know for 20 years, some of them. Anyway, the signal came from the Yanks saying that as aircraft might still be operating, Japanese aircraft, cease hostilities, but if any Japanese aircraft are sighted, they should be shot down in a friendly manner, which I thought was brilliant. And unfortunately, when it did end, as we'd been hit twice by the kamikazes and our steering had been damaged, we were told to go back to Australia straight away. A lot of the other carriers went on to Tokyo for the signing of the actual armistice signing and things. But we had to go back down to Sydney. There was a damaged rudder, of all things. And they'd flown, or got, I don't know how, a new rudder out from England to Sydney. And the idea was, without the bomb, of course, all this was before the bomb, was we should go into dry dock and they'd change the rudder. It was a massive thing, massive. But of course that wasn't required. They repaired the whatever system was that had been damaged in harbour, and the Australians obviously said, well, we don't want this rudder on our doorstep or on our quayside, but take it back. So they hoisted it on board the Victorias on the flight deck and they welded it to the deck. So, because it was an enormous thing, so as it wouldn't drift about in the sea, and we had to bring it home like that on the deck, because we had no intention of operating aircraft anyway, so it didn't matter. But I have rather a good photo here of my girlfriend who came on board in Sydney, well, my Sydney girlfriend, and I've got a photo of her sitting on the rudder of the Victoria. She was a glamorous girl. It's rather fun.
And you returned to the UK in about October time, I believe.
Yes, I think it was the end of October we got back from on the Victorias. We actually got to Portsmouth, I think, on the 27th of October or something like that. And then we had a bit of leave. And then I was sent to the ferry pool at Anthorn, Carlisle, to move aircraft about which were in the wrong places. You always get this... Spitfires or Hurricanes or whatever, Corsairs have got to be taken from here to there. We were just a pool of pilots that sent off to move these aeroplanes. And that's where I started flying other things other than Corsairs. Because the American training, you see, if you fly a Corsair, and that is your lot. You're not going to fly anything else. And it works, if you've got enough men to be able to do it with.
So how did that work when you were flying the other aircraft then?
Oh, it was wonderful to fly something else in peacetime, of course, Well, you got checked out in a Barracuda, a Hellcat, an Avenger, and one or two other things I haven't put down here, but take it to Newcastle or take it to Leon Solent or something, and off you toddled with it.
So very much your own man in doing
that. Oh yeah, because they had no radios, no recognisable markings, because they were all fleet markings by this time or whatever. So nobody knew who you were or what you were doing, so you could please yourself. I flew a Corsair from Carlisle to Leon Solent in 48 minutes. That takes a bit of doing. At 0 feet. Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
Obviously the Fleet Air Arm was running down at that time as well, after the war. Had you considered a career with the Fleet Air Arm at all?
Well, at that time, you could sign up for a permanent commission. But quite frankly, I didn't see the point. There were a lot of RAF people being demobilised, like I was waiting for my demobilisation, and so I was doing this in the meantime. And they'd flown Lancasters and things over Germany for hours and hours and hours. Now, any commercial flying around, they're the boys to get it because they already do it. But nobody wants an idiot like me, or a Corsair pilot, flying a passenger airline. They'd have to completely retrain me, and I couldn't see that happening. I really couldn't. And anyway, I thought I'd done enough. Thinking, when's my luck going to run out again, you know? As Ginger Barlow, as I was telling you, who signed on and then was killed in July 46, just after I'd was demobbed. He was killed.
So, how do you feel now, having served with the Fleet Air Arm during the Second World War?
Oh, that's an honour. A great honour. To have been done something, you know. To have been part of it, as it were. Although, a minimal part, really, because a lot of the people you will see or interview had a lot more operational experience than I did. But I wasn't old enough. I was just that much too young. So, But anyway, no, I couldn't have done it. I couldn't have been happier.